So, dystopia now. Where do I start? There are so many kind of choices for what I could think about. We might start with the election of Donald Trump to the White House. Or perhaps we might start with the prospect of nuclear Armageddon, raised by the two child men, Trump and Kim Jong-il, vying for each other's attention across the globe through an escalation of military engagement. Or perhaps we could start, I was very pleased to be able to say this was for research purposes, that I was looking up pictures of Putin shirtless on a horse and a bear. We could start with the return of the cult of strongman political leadership, embodied in pretty much everything to do with Vladimir Putin. In a recent article for the Financial Times, Gideon Rachman sketches the lineage of contemporary strongman leaders such as Putin, Turkey's Erdogan, and now, of course, Donald Trump. These easy-to-caricature figures often feel like they've been ripped out of the pages of any good dystopian novel. They emerge at times of crisis, characterised, as we've seen recently, by a swing towards nationalism and protectionism, times of global political and economic upheaval, and they encourage cults of personality trying to embody the nation itself. And in this sense, the recent spate of macho leaders echo the strong man of the 1930s, another particularly dystopian moment, such as Mussolini, Hitler and Franco. Just last week, in fact, as part of the Birkbeck Arts Week, we held a panel titled Will 2017 Be 1984? Reconsidering the uncanny relevance of Orwell's novel for our own times in this era of post-truth. Earlier this year, as I'm sure you're no doubt aware, sales of 1984 surged and the novel has become an Amazon bestseller after Trump's advisor Kellyanne Conway used the Orwellian term alternative facts in an interview. So at times of political uncertainty, economic austerity and inequality, fiscal irresponsibility, human rights abuses, an ongoing state of deterritorialised warfare, the migrants crisis, environmental degradation. Good thing it's sunny today, right? It's kind of hard to know where to start with the question dystopia now. So no surprise then, as Yale professor Joe Cleary has recently suggested, the genre of dystopia is currently exercising a huge grip on the popular imagination at a time when people feel threatened by things like state surveillance, the suspension of laws and liberties, and encroachments on democratic society. So I think we're all agreed, and the fact that this has been such a popular event with you all coming here today, that we are witnessing a dystopian revival. And I guess what's interesting about this is also the fact that we're witnessing an interest in specifically literary texts that are being adapted, perhaps, to television and to film. And there are two, I mean, there are so many here, I don't have time to go into them, and you're all talking about some fantastic contemporary examples, but two that I thought I would just point out would include the adaptation of Philip K. Dick's The Man in the High Castle, which was made into a TV series with Ridley Scott and has been Amazon's most watched TV show to date. We'll see if I can keep shouting over the sounds of the digging outside. And of course, Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale from 1985, a novel that, like Orwell's 1984, has similarly seen a dramatic boost in sales since the Trump administration came to power. The novel's been adapted into a series by the streaming service Hulu, and as Margaret Atwood has recently said in interviews, it's enjoying a kind of anachronistic and disturbing revival in the age of Trump. She said, "It's back to 17th century Puritan values of New England, at that time in which women were pretty low in the hierarchy." And her novel has even inspired political activists in the past few months. Women marching, for instance, on the Women's March in January 2017, holding signs that read, "Make Margaret Atwood fiction again." And then again, in March 2017, just a couple of months ago, pro-choice campaigners dressing up, as you can see here, in the distinctive white wimple and the red cloak worn by the enforced childbearing handmaids in the dystopian theocracy of Gilead. They marched through the Texas Senate, which was considering Bill SB 25. So this is the bill whereby parents would be prevented from being able to sue obstetricians who failed to inform them that there were fetal anomalies with their unborn children. As Margaret Johnson of the League of Women Voters of Texas suggested, this bill is a not-so-subtle way of giving medical personnel the opportunity to impose the religious beliefs on pregnant women by withholding information about the condition of their fetus and depriving them of making an informed decision about continuing with their pregnancy. After these handmade protesters were forcibly removed from the Senate, the bill was then subsequently passed into law. Dystopia now. But how did we get here? What I'm going to do today is try and limit myself to a set of readings which focus particularly on the literary genre of dystopia. I would suggest we can't understand dystopian nightmarish near and distant futures without first understanding the utopian impulse that animates fears concerning social and technological engineering. So it's going to be necessary to think about that slippage, and not just because I love utopias, but there is actually a real intellectual reason for thinking about the relationship between them. And this, as I'll suggest, can be thought of as the era of techno-modernity, and it inspires a curiously double-sided speculative response amongst writers. So firstly, then, that techno-modernity gives concrete form to our fear of the loss of modernity or the loss of civilization that we find in so many post-apocalyptic narratives. And of course, the genre of post-apocalypse, like the genre of dystopia, is enjoying an enormous renaissance right now. And this is why we love it. And secondly, then, techno-modernity also inspires our fear of the kind of future that modernity will ultimately deliver in its final perfected incarnation. And this, I would suggest, is why we hate it. So in the spirit of Gregory Kleiss's authoritative new book, Dystopia, A Natural History, it's just out this a month or two ago with OUP, I would like to trace a primarily literary history. But before I do so, I'm going to have to say a few words about techno-modernity. Kleiss's analysis of literary dystopias is particularly helpful for thinking this through. He suggests in his subtitle, A Natural History of the Genre, that we should lay emphasis on the way in which dystopias produce an emotional response with readers and how that response resonates through different times and in different societies. So in anthropological terms, then, we can identify what he calls proto-dystopian elements within earlier human societies, which focus their anxieties upon physical objects observable within the natural world. So he sketches a history through things like animism, mysticism, ritualism, a belief in evil spirits, a belief in the magical, and so on. And then moving into the early modern period, political despotism came to signify what we might now consider to be a proto-dystopian form of state control, which prefigures modern totalitarianism. And he points towards the writings of Machiavelli, Montesquieu, de Tocqueville, and John Stuart Mill. But it's actually the anxieties of the 19th century which most interest me today. The Malthusian fear of overpopulation mixed in with anxieties about the relationship, particularly between capital and labour, economic competition between states, the rapid urbanisation and industrialisation, and, of course, technological innovation. Those earlier fears, Gregory Kleiss suggests, were gradually replaced in later modernity. So the earlier fears to do with animism and magic and so on. And they became either internalised into a mode of inner monstrosity, or they merged and evolved into a fear of the science and technology that we have created, or of the recreation of ourselves in the image of our machines, and of their eventual domination over us. In an excellent edited collection on techno-gothic, Justin Edwards, my namesake but no relation, suggests that techno-science is invoked by those who seek to conflate technology with neocolonialism, those who argue that the advanced technologies of hypercapitalism replicate the techno-modernity which fueled 18th and 19th century imperialism. And he suggests that it's used by writers and critics who are generally wary of technology. So those who identify the integration of humanity with machinery as a kind of Frankenstein-esque turn, which threatens us, he says, with inhumanism. So why is everyone saying such terrible things about techno-modernity? Some of it sounds quite good to me. So I would like to challenge, but also to scrutinise, this idea that there's a Frankenstein-esque turn which threatens us with inhumanism, and to suggest, and I'm not being completely farcical or controversial here, that actually we do love techno-modernity as much as we fear it, and that's why we fear its loss. Herbert Marcuse's 1964 critique of advanced industrial capitalism, One-Dimensional Man, is a useful reference point for thinking this through. As he writes, scientific management and scientific division of labour vastly increased the productivity of the economic, political and cultural enterprise, result, the higher standard of living. At the same time and on the same ground, this rational enterprise produced a pattern of mind and behaviour which justified and absolved even the most destructive and oppressive features of the enterprise.
scientific, technical rationality and manipulation welded together into new forms of social control. So Marcuse then, writing in the 60s, talking about a particular kind of scientific rationality which underpins, he terms it, advanced industrial capitalism, and its ever more dystopian societal control through things like advertising, enforced consumption, positivism, positive thinking. He refers to it as the happy consciousness. We're all obliged to be happy all of the time. Philosophical and linguistic contractions, the reduction of speculative thinking, speculative philosophy, the ability to think alternatives. And of course, it's useful to bear this in mind when we're thinking about the depiction of technology within the literary dystopia. We have to remember, it's not always, sometimes, but it's not always the technologies themselves that frighten us. It's the way in which we use them to enforce inequality, disparity, conformism, and so on. So I'm going today to focus on a few aspects of literary dystopianism, which we can chart through some indicative early texts of the genre. These comprise what Tom Moylan and Raffaella Baccalini would term the classical or canonical form of dystopia. They describe in their influential and great edited collection Dark Horizons, Science Fiction and the Dystopian Imagination. And among these preoccupations of early canonical or classical dystopian texts, the things I'm going to focus on are threefold. The utopian problem of labour. Who is going to do the menial or the hard work in the good society? Are we going to turn to the solution of full automation to relieve ourselves of this drudgery? The question of designing the good society. And in techno-modernity, we're thinking here specifically of urban environments, high-rise, sort of new architectural visions of the future. And thirdly, what is the relationship between the individual subject and the utopian collective? And what happens when collectivization or community becomes forced on you? What happens when that utopian vision slides into dystopian nightmare? What happens to things like privacy, individual space in these techno-modern cities? How are social units organised? Who raises the children? Who does the childbearing? How are communities brought together? I'm particularly interested in these early 20th century texts, partly because I know that many of you here today are going to be talking about contemporary literature, so I thought I'd take us a little bit back and remind ourselves about the early parts of the genre. But also, I would argue that the question of labour relations, which we find again and again in these utopian and dystopian texts, are worth returning to at a time that, I don't know what we call it, post-Fordism, a time in which workers' rights are being challenged, increasingly disintegrating an area of de-unionised labour, of Uber drivers and self-employed mail delivery people and couriers, of zero-hours contract workers, and an army of growing self and underemployed. So, from the utopian dream to the dystopian nightmare. The term dystopia was coined by John Stuart Mill in 1868 in a parliamentary speech denouncing the government's Irish land policy, but it came to be used to describe speculative visions of the future which lacked the optimism of utopia's good society, or, more frighteningly, visions that delivered utopian perfection and required everyone to be forcibly happy, to be ordered, to be productive in a kind of gently leisured sort of way. After a boom in utopian novels in the late 19th century and the fin de siècle, the focus on socialist visions of the collective future then slid into a palpable fear of the kind of modernity that technology would deliver, and also, of course, the loss of liberal values that are implied in this sort of enforced collectivisation. What Susan Butt Moore terms the mass democratic myth of industrial modernity, which she describes as the belief that the industrial reshaping of the world is capable of bringing about the good society by providing material happiness for the masses. Remember Marcuse's improvement to the standard of living. This decisively then gave way to dystopian projects of techno-modernity's dark futures. In the early decades of the 20th century, the extraordinary popularity of H.G. Wells's utopian visions in texts like A Modern Utopia from 1905 and Men Like Gods from 1923, thus provoked satirical responses amongst his colleagues and inspired our earliest properly dystopian narratives, as we'll come to see. And so Wells is perhaps the best place to start in thinking about the shift from utopia to dystopia, which visions of techno-modernity tend to inspire. As Majid Yar writes, H.G. Wells's writing can be read as a positive utopianism situated firmly in with the techno-scientific imaginary of European modernity. Science and technology, the application of scientific rationality, are for Wells a means to make a good society. He believed in these things. He felt they would deliver a better future for all of us. But, of course, Wells wasn't unaware of the contradictions that are inherent in the utopian imagination as it has become formalised in a literary genre. Contradictions such as the necessity of having an obedient populace, a harmonious set of citizens, how we solve that problem of labour I mentioned, how we solve the problem of balancing resources with demographics without resorting to some kind of eugenic control, how we maintain the peace with volatile neighbours in our early modern city-state. Indeed, in the modern utopia, Wells challenges the vision of static perfection associated with the classical literary utopias, particularly those Renaissance utopias. So we're thinking here of Thomas More's 1516 originary text, Tommaso Campanella's City of the Sun from 1603, and Margaret Cavendish's The Blazing World from 1666. In A Modern Utopia, as the botanist and his companion trek through the alpine landscape of Utopia, their experience is mediated by the irascible observations of the voice, the narrator, who freely complains about the shortcomings of traditional utopian narratives, such as the miraculous acquisition of language that is necessary to engaging with the utopian people, the helpful guides, the hospitable guest houses, and the harmonious political order which characterises these utopian loci. Wells's novel, by contrast, asserts that it is realistic, that it has a philosophical discussion of utopian states, not of ordered perfection, but, as he puts it, arriving at a philosophy of fragmentation that ends amidst a gross tumult of immediate realities. On the eve of the outbreak of the Second World War, H.G. Wells visited Australia, delivering two lectures, one of which was on utopias. He remarked that throughout the ages, utopias reflect the anxieties and discontents amidst which they were produced. They are, so to speak, shadows of light thrown by darknesses. Wells recognised this intrinsic connection between utopian dreams and the dark conditions that inspire writers to venture into the realms of the speculative imagination. And I would suggest many of his major works themselves explore how the vision of the good society, which is, as Thomas More's coinage suggests, the good place that is also no place, can slide into its dystopian counterpart. When he first arrives in the future world of the Morlocks and the Eloi, the time traveller in the time machine thinks he's landed in a pastoral Arcadia until he comes to understand, as illustrated excellently here by the mid-century TV version, that the graceful childlike Eloi are in fact fatted cattle for these troglodytic labouring Morlocks. The Sleeper Awakes from 1910 also plays with utopian form, building on William Morris's premise of miraculously waking up in the utopian future that we found in News from Nowhere. However, instead of waking up in a world of social equality, the protagonist Graham discovers the technologically advanced society of 2100 has evolved into a distinctly anti-utopian society of, quote, higher buildings, bigger towns, wickeder capitalists, and labour more downtrodden than ever. Just to highlight a few of the utopian aspects of Men Like Gods, I hope you enjoy the diagram, I spent some time on it. So in 1923, he returned to the theme of utopia in Men Like Gods. It combines utopian philosophical discourse with a kind of narrative propulsion of an adventure story. The protagonist, Mr. Barnstable, decides one day, as I suppose we all might, that he needs a holiday from his family, and he drives off towards the Lake District. But somewhere in Slough, he slides off the road and into a kind of parallel world. The utopian contours of this parallel universe are immediately apparent from the road's strangely glassy surface, the kind of beautiful mountainous landscape, and as you can see here, the tame leopard that sort of ambles friendly past. With its southern European climate, the utopian countryside strikes him as the consummation of a million ancient dreams. Wells's rational utopia in this novel is described in deliberately and specifically scientific and utilitarian terms. As he learns about this advanced world, Mr. Barnstable cannot help but admire its horticulture, its impressive industry, all of those aqueducts, and of course its socialised communities. It represents progress. It's 3,000 years more advanced than Earth, which it describes as its retarded sister universe. And despite his obvious admiration, he also finds it austere and terrifying. He says, "Life marched here." Sorry, the narrator says, "Life marched here. It was terrifying to think with what strides." Terrifying, because at the back of Mr. Barnstable's mind, as at the back of so many intelligent minds of our world still, had been the persuasion that presently everything would be known and the scientific process come to an end and then we should be happy forever after. So this insatiable march of scientific progress leads, in Men Like Gods, to eugenic experiments in improving mankind. There are no defective people in this utopia, no cripples, no criminals, not even anyone who has a lethargic disposition or a weak imagination, so we better watch out. And of course, eugenics have haunted many literary utopias, going back as far as Plato's Republic or Campanella's The City of the Sun. It's this aspect of Wells's Men Like Gods which inspired Aldous Huxley's eugenicist dystopia Brave New World. In 1962, Huxley recalled his frustration with this novel in particular. He said, "Men Like Gods annoyed me to the point of planning a parody, but when I started writing, I found the idea of a negative utopia so interesting that I forgot about Wells and I launched into Brave New World." With their desire for perfected humanity, Wells's austere scientific utopians thus reveal the fine slippage between utopian dream and dystopian nightmare. Like Aldous Huxley, E.M. Forster was similarly inspired by the novel Men Like Gods, and he wrote a futuristic speculative story of his own from 1909 called The Machine Stops. As he explained some years later, the novella was, I quote, "a reaction to one of the earlier heavens of Mr. H.G. Wells," which has subsequently then degenerated into a dystopia. In this novel, the Earth's surface has become so polluted that everyone needs to live underground. Humanity is tunnelling deep in a subterranean urban network, perhaps recalling the artilleryman's vision of future life after the Martian invasion in Wells's War of the Worlds. It depicts an advanced society with sophisticated telecommunications, which I think we would all recognise today. The narrator asks at the beginning to imagine, if you can, a small room, hexagonal in shape, like the cell of a bee. It is lighted neither by window nor by lamp, yet it is filled with a soft radiance. There are no apertures for ventilation, yet the air is fresh. There are no musical instruments, and yet at the moment that my meditation opens, this room is throbbing with melodious sounds. An armchair is in the centre, by its side a reading desk. This is all the furniture. And in the armchair there sits a swaddled lump of flesh, a woman about 5 feet high, with a face as white as a fungus. So recalling this kind of consumptive, feeble grace, it echoes in some ways the childlike Eloy, I think, from The Time Machine, where Ian Forster's futuristic image of flaccid humanity conveys the physical debilitations which result from our over-reliance on technology. These innovations in the story are collectively referred to as the machine, which has come to replace all aspects of daily life in a sterile vision of full automation. Vashti, this pallid protagonist with her face as white as a fungus, doesn't move from her pod, and yet she communicates with friends all over the world. She delivers lectures to a worldwide audience. She listens to music, receives books, and is even administered medical treatment, all by pressing a series of buttons and electrical switches which contribute to the perpetual humming of the machine. And although it accurately predicts contemporary technologies, things like Skype, the internet, and YouTube, Forster's vision of this futuristic society also has its sort of endearingly retro elements. This prospect of an accelerated age is manifested in a kind of grotesque materiality of the machine's technology, the mending apparatus that sort of self-administers, mends itself, for want of a better word, is referred to as like a long white worm which crawls out of an access shaft. But I think the most dystopian aspect of the story is the deliverance of complete isolation. Despite her extensive virtual social network, Vashti suffers the terrors of direct experience, and she tries to avoid seeing her son, Kuno, face to face. Kuno has managed to ascend to the surface of the Earth and explored what's going on. He's got up through a pneumatic stopper. And at one point in the text, he has a diatribe against the machine. And this is staged in a utopian discourse which Forster's readership would have recognised. Humanity, he says, in its desire for comfort, had overreached itself. It had exploited the riches of nature too far. Quietly and complacently, it was sinking into decadence, and progress had come to mean the progress of the machine. So progress, but for whom? The dangers of this technological dependency become apparent to Kuno when he realises that the machine is stopping. So it starts to dispense mouldy food, the bathwater gets dirty, and perhaps most tellingly of all, the poetry machine, which gives poetry mechanically to people, starts to emit defective rhymes. And when it finally grinds to a halt, Kuno and Vashti rise up to the surface of the earth. They're reunited as the city breaks apart like a honeycomb. And for a moment, they saw the nations of the dead, and before they joined them, scraps of the untainted sky. So this is a very dystopian image. They die at the end of the novel. But there perhaps might be slightly more utopian implications than Forster intended. Tom Moylan, in Scraps of the Untainted Sky, quoting the end of the story, suggests the implied existence of a rebel band of homeless fugitives in the story, and argues that this might deliver a more hopeful warning by evoking a powerful memory informed by some achieved utopian future beyond the story of the text, in which an unnamed narrator relates this tale of life, looking back to our dystopian present in the story as a distant, vanished dystopian past. And although Forster's novella from 1909 is often referred to as being one of the earliest dystopian texts, and I think perhaps the fact that he responds directly to Wells's utopian visions might have something to do with that scholarly framing, there are critics who suggest we can look further back into the 19th century for dystopian precursors. Émile Souvestre's Le Monde tel qu'il sera, The World as It Will Be, from 1846, for example, would fit into this reading of what we might term early dystopias of monopoly capitalism. That is, texts which focus on commercialism, the rise of corporatic elites. A satirical narrative warns, then, in this novel, of an over-reliance on technology and a bleak future vision of a world where man had become enslaved by machines and where interest had replaced love. The two protagonists are afforded this vision of the future when John Progress, who embodies the future, suddenly appears outside their window in a flying locomotive and conducts them via mesmeric trance to the year 3000. Although the familiar tropes we've come to associate with dystopian literature, things like children being separated at birth from their biological parents, being raised in segregated communities, a near future prophetic vision of technology, and in this novel in particular, it anticipates the Underground Railway, which hadn't actually opened. The London Metropolitan Line didn't open until 1863, a decade or two later. And it also anticipates our own contemporary era of 24-hour news cycles. There's the novel contains a perpetual newspaper, which is printed on an endless sheet of paper that is conducted through every household on a conveyor belt. But among the more bizarre futuristic aspects are the replacement of bridges with cannons. So if you want to cross a river, you have to get shot over, and fires people around the place. And perhaps my favourite, the privatisation of Switzerland into a giant theme park. As Paul Alcon notes then, Souvestre's tour of our planet in the year 3000 inaugurates futuristic dystopias with truly Orwellian vigour and consistency, but in a decidedly more comic mode than 1984, perhaps owing a little bit more to the tradition of literary satire from Gulliver's Tales, for example, Jonathan Swift. A more sober and technophobic vision of the dangers of mechanisation can be found in Ignatius Donnelly's Caesar's Column from 1890. So we're starting to move now towards the final decade of the 19th century when we have an increasing number of utopian stories of the future. It extrapolates the worst excesses of monopoly capitalism into this near future. Donnelly himself was an agrarian populist, active in US politics, and writing a number of books on a range of subjects, as well as founding a newspaper and working with the Farmers' Alliance. He led the Granger movements against the railroads, as well as being a senator of Minnesota. As Tom Brass notes, in his fiction and his non-fiction writing, Donnelly then contributed to the construction and consolidation of anti-finance and anti-foreign capital, anti-state discourse that constituted the mobilising ideology of farmers' protest movements, the Grangers, the Greenbackers, the Farmers' Alliance. Movements that took place in the Midwest and the southern states of America towards the end of the 19th century. The mass appeal, and hence the political impact of Caesar's Column, therefore lies in the domain of popular culture, and this is without question. A decade after its publication, some 230,000 copies of the book had already been sold in the US and almost 500,000 in Europe. And it, of course, strikes us then that these kind of protectionist and anti-foreign capital narratives actually speak in an alarming way to our situation, in the contemporary. The tensions then between capital on the one hand, in this instance we're talking about the railroad trusts in America, and Labour on the other, embodied in Donnelly's text in the Granger movement. So this is where farmers' cooperatives were trying to buy up land in the 1870s to try and move towards state control of the railways, railway nationalisation, anybody? And also of the grain elevators that served these trains. It's also the subject of Frank Norris's anti-railroad novel, The Octopus, from 1901. This novel is the first book in a planned epic trilogy about the production of wheat, its distribution and consumption, which was followed by The Pit in 1902, but sadly remained unfinished when Norris subsequently died. Norris depicts the brutally violent confrontation between the ranchers and a railroad trust, which was inspired by the real-life event known as the Muscle Slough tragedy of 1880. His anti-railroad position depicted these railroad moguls as venal and ruthless during the great age of the American Railroad War. And in that sense, he's drawing on French literary naturalists, things like Balzac and Zola, and novels about the kind of venal bourgeoisie in Paris in the mid-19th century, and how they're consolidating all of the wealth, and how these great European banking families are starting to emerge. So although Frank Norris is a canonised writer within the school of American literary naturalism, you wouldn't usually find him referred to in a literary history of dystopia. Philip Wegner includes the briefest of references to Norris's populism in a chapter on naturalism and dystopia in that Dark Horizons collection I mentioned earlier. But I would suggest that if we rethink the beginnings of the dystopian genre, or acknowledge some of its significant precursors through the lens of these novels about monopoly capitalism, this then opens up a different way of thinking about the evolution of the genre. And I think it can help us to clarify the interrelationship between technology, modernity, and futurity outside of what is more commonly used as a kind of framework of it's liberal individualism versus authoritarian collectivization. I actually think returning to questions of monopoly capitalism brings in a slightly different focus to bear on these texts. Turning now then to a more orthodox example of this set of sort of proto-early dystopias, we arrive at Jack London's The Iron Heel from 1908, which presents a brutal vision of an oppressive capitalist oligarchy in the near future, given the eponymous epithet of the Iron Heel. As with Donnelly's Caesar's Column and Norris's The Octopus, London's narrative feels increasingly relevant for our own times, dystopia now, as we attempt to navigate the shadowy underworld of global capital, which seemingly cannot be halted and can barely be traced as it flows between markets and states, at the speed of digital instantaneity. In the early decades of the Iron Heel's speculative 20th century, then, London's narrator Avis details the rise of corporate monopolies as independent businesses are put out of business, this inevitable economic evolution of monopolistic trusts emerges. This includes the railroad trust, as we've already heard about, the oil trust, the steel trust, the coal trust, and the tobacco trust. Avis's husband, Ernest, is really the hero of the novel, a socialist revolutionary of the story, warns that if America's trusts win this evolutionary economic battle, everyone outside of a small oligarchic minority will be crushed under the iron heel of a despotism as relentless and terrible as any despotism that has blackened the pages of the history of man. And of course, this is what happens. And what follows is an eerily prescient account of Cold War stratagems. As on the one hand, you've got the Iron Heel capitalists, and on the other hand, you've got the socialists. They're attempting to undermine one another with a new and strange and awful subterranean warfare. Meanwhile, the numbers of starving Americans reaches millions. And in the last few chapters of the novel, London returns to an earlier theme of poverty that he had explored in his expose of London's East End slums, The People of the Abyss. And we have a bloody civil war taking place in 1918. Again, another really uncanny kind of presage. Scholars debate whether The Iron Heel can actually be categorised as a dystopian novel, given that it has a narrative framework. It's presented as a historical document which resurfaces in a distant utopian future. As Tom Moylan suggests, London's novel then is almost a dystopia, or perhaps a proto-dystopia. So with its frame narrative, you have a kind of scholarly introduction, you have all of these footnotes from this fictional editor of the manuscript who lives in the 26th century in a socialist utopian future, the Brotherhood of Man, when everything has been solved, all of capitalism's contradictions have led to a harmonious society. And so in this sense, the Iron Heel is certainly not a straightforward dystopian vision, and this narrative framing device of a much more distant post-dystopian, post-totalitarian future is a device that we'll see again. We'll see it, for instance, in Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. And the containment within the text of a non-diegetic post-dystopian world reveals the formal complexity that we come up against when we're trying to theorise the blurry lines between dystopian and utopian modes of futurity. So from the monopolies of the American Railroad Trusts in the Midwest to the urban centres of manufacturing and Frederick Taylor's spurious principles of scientific management, we come to Yevgeny Zamyatin's 1924 novel We, which takes its inspiration from Taylor's ideas of efficient production and their application to social life. In a distant future of a 26th century authoritarian city-state, Zamyatin rehearses a nightmare of unthinking production. The narrator, D503, we don't have names anymore, we don't have individual subjectivity, we're all just numbers, works as a mathematician in one state, building the integral machine, a gigantic glass spacecraft designed to manufacture inescapable happiness. It will be forced on us, and this happiness must be spread across the galaxy. Using a strict... one state has then this dehumanising system of numerical perfection. It has replaced individuality and emotion with a strict regimen of equations, formulae, obedient citizens. Every morning we learn with six-wheeled precision at the very same hour and the very same minute, we get up, millions of us, as though we are one. And architecture plays a crucial role in this futuristic vision of one state. The authoritarian city's glass paradise is described by D503 in terms of Euclidean perfection, with unalterably straight streets, sparkling glass sidewalks, and transparent dwellings. So, of course, we've lost any sense of privacy now. We can all be seen at all times. And although he disliked its cubist architecture, Zamyatin's authoritarian city shares some of the functionalist ethos of Le Corbusier's design for living in texts like Toward an Architecture, where he described the house as a machine for living in. So we have then this juxtaposition of a kind of collective realm of order, of administrative bureaucracy, and the individualist realm of where we live, our own domestic space being transparent, we can see into it. Similarly inspired by the productive efficiency of Taylorism and Fordism, then, we find another really interesting vision in a not very well-known text by Valerie Brusiov, The Republic of the Southern Cross. As Richard Stites notes then, the gleaming giant cities of the future generated revulsion in some quarters. And a good example of this is Brusiov's short story. It narrates the collapse of a highly technologised modern city where a mysterious illness leads to a bloody epidemic. This was a utopian city in which the state was so efficient, the welfare state was so efficient that nobody needed wages, and that there was a sort of sense of harmony. And then it's suddenly undercut by this mysterious plague, this disease that spreads through. And what I think is particularly interesting about this early Russian dystopia is the way in which it illustrates the two sides of our response to techno-modernity, that is, how we love it and also how we fear it. Whilst it initially delivers the kind of dystopian future in which techno-modernity has somehow inevitably resulted in an extreme form of standardisation architecturally, socially, politically and so on through collectivised living, it then shifts gear and it becomes basically an apocalyptic narrative of what happens when society completely breaks down. And eventually Star City is reduced to a city of the senseless, the gigantic madhouse, the greatest and most disgusting bedlam the world has ever seen. If the anxieties in these early Russian examples, like Brusiov's and Zamyatin's texts of the literary dystopia, combine a fear of collectivization, then, with a fear of the collapse of industrial modernity, the collapse of societal, of the way in which we live in techno-modernity, by the time we come to the 1930s, the dangers of fascism are really what is preoccupying dystopian writers. And so now we reach the figures with which you'll probably be most familiar. Dystopian realities then speaking to the rise of Hitler's Nazism, the attempts at social engineering, something which has obviously plagued the novel since Moore's Utopia in 1516. Moving on, I've probably got 5 minutes, right? Yeah, so I'll go on a little more quickly. So in Huxley's Brave New World then, Obviously, it's a eugenicist future, towering banks of bottled fetuses, and, returning to Herbert Marcuse's point earlier, forced consumption, right? That we have to solve the problems of capitalism's overproduction of goods by all having to consume more, and in order to consume more, we have to be drugged up on soma. So, as he says in the preface to Brave New World, utopias seem much more attainable than one may have previously thought. This is Huxley quoting Berdyaev. And we are now faced with a much more frightening thought. How do we prevent their permanent fulfilment? So in this text, then, again, we find the central premise of the utopian problem of labour, degrading unskilled labour. Rather than a sci-fi vision of full robotic automation, here we have basically entrenched inequality and an advanced caste system of genetically engineered future humans, induced into a state of permanent happiness and ceaseless consumption. In the 1930s as well, there were a number of feminist anti-fascist dystopias, perhaps the best known of which would be Catherine Burdekin's Swastika Night, published under the name of Murray Constantine. It's interesting, of course, to think about the way in which these feminist texts managed to extrapolate something out of the dangers of fascism at the time that many other texts overlooked, and that is this idea of the cult of masculinity. And Swastika Night is a really terrifying future vision of what happens when women are utterly degraded and subjugated. And for anyone looking at Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, obviously Swastika Night is a really important precursor. Okay, moving towards a conclusion. I'd like to then close by considering the issue of formal complexity and this ambiguity between dystopian and utopian literary form that we find time and again in canonical literary dystopias, and with reference here specifically to the appendix of George Orwell's 1984 and also the historical frame narrative of Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. I'm sure they need little introduction to this audience. So I think these... Sorry, let me just edit on the hoof so that I don't run on too long. I think finding the marriage of these kind of two fears about techno-modernity in a novel like 1984, for instance, where you have a kind of vision of high-tech futurity, ultimate surveillance, Big Brother is watching all of us, but you also have a particularly low-tech, lo-fi kind of system of World War II rationing being extended into the future, crumbling architecture, the smell of boiled cabbage and leaky shoes and so on. It reminds us then of our two fears about techno-modernity, that we might have to do without it, the low-tech option or the post-tech option, as you find in post-apocalyptic narratives, but also that it will deliver a future which is the logical summation of its own internal logic, positivism, linear progress, the dialectic of enlightenment, and so on, and that is the high-tech option. Returning then to the end of 1984, the novel, the story, the homodiegetic narrative, ends with... Winston, drunk, in a gin-fueled stupor in the Chestnut Tree Cafe. It's a particularly tragic image. He's finally learned how to love Big Brother. And you feel this complete despair when you end the novel, ending with this inescapably dystopian image. Or does it? So various critics, in fact, Margaret Atwood herself, talks about Orwell's appendix in... the section on Newspeak right at the end. She says it's written in a standard English in the third person and in the past tense, which can only mean that the regime has fallen, that language and individuality have survived. For whoever has written that essay on Newspeak, the world of 1984 is over. And, of course, she took that form and updated it with her own Handmaid's Tale, with the historical notes. You'll remember, of course, that... The Handmaid's Tale is a manuscript which is being discussed at an academic conference in the distant future, the 12th Symposium of Gileadian Studies in 2195. It's been compiled from oral testimony on these old-fashioned things called cassette tapes, which they had to sort of miraculously revive and come up with a machine that could replay them, and then they transcribe the story of Offred. And the way in which the academics talk about this oral testimony, they talk about an underground female road of activists who defied the Gilead theocracy in order to escape and send out this message and carry this footlocker of testimony, of documents. As the keynote professor notes, did our narrator reach the outside world safely and build a new life for herself, or was she discovered in her attic hiding place, arrested, or even executed? So these framing devices, these narratorial devices, as Andrew Milner says, serve to relativise dystopia by historicising it. And some scholars have gone so far as to suggest that these historicisations should be considered as utopian literary frames that themselves contain the central dystopian narrative. As Paul Resch suggests, this is a frequently overlooked feature of 1984, and it confirms that there may well be a post-totalitarian world of the narrative's distant future, looking back at Oceania's dystopian regime as an extinct and almost incomprehensible civilization. So just to close then, if we agree that we are currently living in dystopia now, in the second decade of the 21st century as it draws to a close, in our own Trumpian and Brexit-fueled era of post-truth challenges to the democratic process, perhaps the genre of dystopia as a literary form could point towards some distant glimmer of hope at some future time. I hope so. Thank you very much.